It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls, where artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development and Associate Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI. Today's conversation focuses on the healing power of music, exploring physiological and psychological phenomena, and the ways playing music can help your brain.
And today we have with us Dr. Sherry Robb. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, it's great to be here today.
Great to have you. And Becky Archibald.
Hello. Hi.
And Sherry is a music therapist in the IU Simon Cancer Center, and Rebecca is a composer and musician. And I thought that the two of you would be absolutely perfect. Actually, it was a great suggestion from Krista to have you guys come on. And so we're so glad to think about healing and that music might be able to be an instrument of that. And so, Sherry, that is something you do clinically, right? It is music therapy. So can you describe for the listeners what music therapy is?
Sure. So in training, I'm a music therapist, and I've worked for quite a number of years with pediatric cancer patients and their families, using music therapy as a supportive care intervention to really help manage distress and support young children, as well as adolescents and young adults as they're going through their cancer treatment. So I'm on faculty at the School of Nursing, and much of my work today now centers in the research space at looking at how do these interventions work, do they work, for whom do they work, those types of questions. And I'm on faculty at the IU School of Nursing, so kind of moving from the purely clinical space into the clinical research space.
Wow, that's a really big jump when you do that. Because now you get into more than just doing the work. You have to figure out what the questions are that you need to be able to ask and to be able to frame those.
Yes.
So, and Becky, I know you've used music in so many different ways other than just composing. Anything you want to say about this kind of area as we begin?
Working with my daughter who has a disability and seeing how music has transformed her, really. There's so much learning that has occurred because we did it through music. It provides her immediate happiness, you know, hearing her favorite song or something that she danced to in high school, you know, remembering all the moves and everything. And so there's that. And then just example of a friend of mine who had Alzheimer's. When we saw her, it had been maybe 7 years since I'd seen her. I hadn't seen her ill like that. And she'd really lost a lot of weight. And I think she was 62 at the time. This was several years ago. Her daughters said that she didn't know them anymore. She said, she's not going to know you. We started singing and she started singing with us. She also held my hand, and made this tapping pattern on my arm that was signaling to me her that she knew us. I can't take credit for it, but she remained alive for two more years. She weighed about 80 pounds. She had just, she looked like she was going to go that week. But that was just fascinating and beautiful how how that just sparked her from us singing songs that she would know.
What a beautiful story, Becky. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
And that for me kind of makes me think about the very broad relationships between when we think about healing, sometimes people I think associate the idea of healing with curing, and that's not always what we're talking about, right? We're talking mm-hmm. about sort of quality of life, talking about connecting with others. Sherry, can you talk a little bit about some of the clinical outcomes that you have found in the research or that music therapists broadly use to sort of guide their approaches to connecting with folks, maybe with chronic illnesses, for example?
Yeah, so it's exciting to hear Becky share that story and talk about the responses that we're seeing through music for her friend who had Alzheimer's or dementia. And, music therapists, along with, there's so many applications of music. So to kind of go back to Mark's question about music therapy and then Becky talking about I'm not a trained music therapist, but using music and seeing these powerful impacts both for her daughter and for her friends. It's kind of part of what is really happening right now with the National Institutes of Health and their focus on the Sound Health Initiative. And even more recently, the formation of what's called the Sound Health Network, which I'm a part of. It's out at University of California in San Francisco and has support from the National Endowment for the Arts, but also through the NIH. And part of the importance of this group is it's bringing together diverse groups of people. So clinical music therapists, community musicians, different stakeholder groups, researchers from different fields in order to advance our understanding for how does music help support health and well-being. And that can be in a community space, but it can also be in more of a clinical setting. So what we're learning, we already have a growing body of research that helps us understand, well, how is music being processed in the brain? But when you overlay that evidence about, well, how does music process in the brain with things like brain disorders of aging, so like Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's, how does that disease process affect the brain so that we can better understand? So music therapists are taking that evidence and developing experiences or interventions to help promote responses and well-being. So in the case that Becky described, a music therapist might facilitate music experiences with the individual who has Alzheimer's and their family members to sustain social connectedness at a time when their memory is failing, but yet they still have access to these long-term memories that are really triggered by music. But not just music therapists doing these things, but how can we then take clinically what's happening and help other people to do these things as well to improve and promote quality of life? So it really is an incredibly exciting time right now, both in the research community, but also the amount of excitement and attention from the public about the importance of music for health and well-being more broadly.
You know, when you're talking, Sherry, it reminds me of how misunderstood for a long time we've been about how memory is constructed and what we're learning about that there are multiple pathways built around memory and that one of those other pathways that might not be damaged through an illness like Alzheimer's or something else, that there's another pathway sometimes to igniting memories, including the memory of someone that you know that knows you. We know that even in really young kids who have other disorders, like I think of Williams, which is another one that I was familiar with students, whose only pathway to get them to understand was by singing it to them. And that they could actually hear what I was saying by me putting it in song. So that's amazing. I know you're doing a bunch of research right now. What are you really trying to look at right now?
Yeah, so my particular area of research is focused in on pediatric cancer patients. I've worked with both adolescents and younger children, but right now our research is focused on children ages 3 to 8 who have cancer, but also their parents. And so we're looking at how does active music making and music and play in particular help address the emotional distress that young children with cancer experience, but also their parents, because we know that that stress is highly interrelated. And so really it's pulling on theories and research that look at how can music and active music making regulate emotion. You know, you talked about memories and how memories get encoded, and we know that experiences that have a very high emotional balance get encoded in the brain differently than maybe our other day-to-day experiences. And when you think about how the music affects us emotionally, how does it, people are investigating how music affects different centers of the brain related to emotion. You can see how there's a strong potential for either changing how an experience might get encoded as stressful or less stressful or benign, or how it might help regulate these very high levels of emotion and give people relief. So we're actually integrating now biomarkers of stress, and we're looking at how, at a biological level, how are these active music making sessions that are facilitated by a music therapist helping to lower their immediate levels of stress that we're measuring through cortisol in their saliva and blood. And if that's the case, if it does end up affecting it enough, does it have potential to actually improve immune function for our kids downstream? You know, in the longer term, what we're really interested in is that we know that young children and parents, not all of them, but some of them, experience traumatic stress symptoms after their treatment's over. And a lot of that is because of the really hard, challenging things that they experience while they're going through treatment. So we know we can't take that away. It's always going to be hard, awful, terrible. But based on our interviews with our parents, what it does do is it gives them this moment in time where they are able to oftentimes see their child be joyful, playful, active. And for their parents, what happens is they experience immediate relief. Once they see that their child's feeling better, all of their stress kind of lowers, and they get a reminder of what it doesn't always have to all be the terrible parts of cancer. There's actually really wonderful parts where we get to be a family. So if we can do that at the right amount, can we buffer the impact of that cancer diagnosis and treatment so that they will have less debilitating stress symptoms in the longer term? So that's kind of what we're trying to study and figure out. What is it about the experience that helps? And can we use this in a way to kind of help buffer that impact of cancer?
That's such exciting work. And for me, as I am listening to you talk, Sherry, Becky, I'm thinking about something that you said related to your daughter and her experiences, and thinking about the relationship between music and the body, and making music in the body or dance, right? That the experiences that we're talking about with music can potentially be passive. You can just be listening to something, but often the way that we're interacting with music involves some kind of movement, whether that's, again, active music making, or even talking about your friend and sort of tapping as a, you know, that wanting to move. In your experience, Becky, just as a musician and, you know, working with those that you love and, you know, folks around you, have you seen that sort of relationship between sort of the physicality of music and how it shapes the way that folks respond?
There's that layer of protection of I can't show. And when you see someone who doesn't have that layer and they just burst out in movement, you know, it's there for everybody, but there's some video floating around. It was just made in New York a couple of weeks ago, but someone made a sign that said something like stand here and wait or something. I forget what it said, but maybe it was something about dance. As soon as someone put their feet on this little decal that was put on the sidewalk, then they got a show. Then people started dancing for them. And it was just, it was so sweet because it was as if no one was looking at them, and they were just immediately taken and started dancing along with these people who were, you know, they were planned. The person that stepped on it, their movements were not planned, but it was so immediate and unprotected. I don't know if that's the right word, but you know, they just let it out. So it's fun when you see, when you're playing, you're giving a live concert and you see someone responding with movement, and then you see other people sitting still, you know, it's like, oh, come on, let it out, you know. But we're taught to be, you know, like in a classical audience situation, you're not even supposed to clap between movements. And because I write music and I straddle between classical and jazz, and I take my classical concepts and put them in the jazz situation and vice versa. The jazz situations, I think of jazz as a place with surprises and more smiles, because you're delighted because you're surprised all the time with what people are doing, because it's not the same every time. And there's always clapping during the song because someone did a solo and you clap for them. So when I'm performing my chamber music, I'm usually like, it's okay, go ahead and clap. Let it out.
I think that notion of letting it out, though, is a really important part of what Sherry is talking about in her work. I think about just the incredible stress that these families feel. And Sherry, I'm not surprised at all to hear you talk about the way in which parents and children experience that as trauma, right? Because the experience of having cancer is certainly one that would fit that definition. And I think that in part because of the way that our culture sort of frames illness, there are a set of responses that seem appropriate, and sometimes protecting ourselves, as you said, Becky, can be really its own set of emotional labor that's required. So music in some ways gives us, it sounds like what you're saying, is gives you a space to sort of let some of that out in a physical way. And I think that that's a really powerful, a powerful concept. And I'm glad to hear, Sherry, that you're studying that.
Yeah. And I think music's not really, I really enjoyed hearing Becky talk about that, because music is not really a passive experience. It's actually pretty hard to be passive while you're experiencing music, even if you're in an audience, you know, listening. And because, you know, our motor systems, music rhythm at its very core is so powerful in evoking responses from the listener. It's been really exciting, given that, Becky, that you do concerts and community. I heard you talking about community concerts before we started our conversation, and the importance of people coming together.
Yeah.
And, you know, not that this is my area of expertise, but there's a growing amount of research looking at synchronization and movement in groups. So like when you go to a group concert, you're moving in rhythm together, you're experiencing something together, you experience those same emotional changes. And what you often see is a much more strong sense of community and empathy that builds from being together, which I think is a powerful thing for our country to think about in terms of building cohesion and community and togetherness. And I think that's the power that music experiences, especially group or community-based concert, group music making, has a lot of power to do.
You know, I think, Sherry, that sometimes when we talk about any kind of therapy in terms of something that a lot of people, you know, art therapy or painting therapy, you know, there's even drama and those. When we get to music, I think people somehow think it's out there on the fringe. And how do you combat that? I mean, what do music therapists do to help? I know one of them is the research you're doing, but what else?
Yeah, and I think the important thing to realize too is, well, I guess I would assert, I don't think music or creative arts therapies are like a panacea, like it's helpful for everything. or everyone. Those are part of the questions we're investigating. Under what circumstances and for whom does this actually clinically create something that's got significant impact? But on the fringe, I guess from the from a music therapist's training, they're actually trained to do to synthesize evidence that would suggest that music could be helpful in a particular circumstance. So it's very evidence-based, research-based, at least from a clinical music therapist's. They end up doing assessments to figure out what's happening with your client or with your patient. What do they respond to? What's their background? What is it that they hope to accomplish through music? And then it's, building up that assessment and valuation to formulate a plan for how you're going to use music. So I think music therapists approach those situations differently than in like a non-clinical setting or using music for self-help. A lot of times people will report experiences of, I played piano or I shared this kind of music and it had this healing effect. Which is just a different approach than, say, you going to see a clinical music therapist for a service that's for a specific problem and there's documentation and clinical assessments that are happening. So it's different. It's a more, I kind of think of music therapy is more of the specialized application. So like I go to my exercise gym for physical health and emotional health benefits that come from exercise. And there may be an exercise trainer, but if I were going to a physical therapist for an injury on my leg, they have a different type of specialized training and it's for a clinical problem. So I really see like the whole music and health conversation to encompass like this continuum of uses of music. At one end, you've got specialized care that's really centered in this clinical assessment, evidence-based research space. But there are so many other ways that music can be used that's helpful and beneficial and healthful that doesn't necessarily require a clinician. And I think those are part of the questions we're trying to answer too through research as well.
That's really so interesting, and it has to be really rewarding work to validate things that really have been fundamental questions that you have. We're talking with Sherry Robb and Becky Archibald about the healing power of music. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton, and today we're having a conversation about the healing power of music with Sherry Robb and Becky Archibald. Becky, I know that you shared before the break a little bit about your daughter and her relationship to music. Can you talk a little bit more about her and about how music helps her sort of think about the world differently?
Sure. She's 28 years old. She has cerebral palsy. There are several forms of cerebral palsy, but she can still walk and talk and sing and dance and read and she doesn't. Her emotions are slower and what's the word? She doesn't have any spasticity that some types of cerebral palsy you have. And she has this great love of music. Part of it could be that she has someone creating music in her home all the time. But I was saying during the break that she has a memory for music that's completely fascinating to me because it's everything she's ever heard. I remember before I was a composer, I was playing with her when she was a little baby, you know, maybe she was a year and a half old. I don't know. And I started, I made up this little tune. I still remember it, but I was hitting her belly going, belly, belly, good to me. Yeah. Belly, belly, good to me. Oh, belly, belly, good to me. She still sings that song that I sang when she was here. And I, it wasn't like we sang it all the time. It just, one day I was hitting her. I mean, I was doing something that maybe I said the word belly, I don't know, but she started singing that song and it was just, that was mind boggling. But then over the years, she's just cataloged every single song she's ever heard, including the belly song, with, you know, every word. So like, and sometimes she has difficulties pronouncing things, but if she starts a song, you do not interrupt. She's got to sing every verse because she knows the whole thing, every song. And I was saying that if we could say a word, she could start singing a song. We don't know why until she's gotten to that third verse. And then we notice either it's the same word that we just said, or it rhymes with it or something, but we're like, why did she sing that song? Oh, it's because it has that. Cause she's anyway, we've just been amazed by it, but just curious about, we've never really, you know, investigated clinically or talked with doctors. I mean, we didn't see any reason to. I was just curious, since I have you guys, I thought it might be fun to mention it and see what insights you have. And I mean, it's definitely been, it's an instant, also an instant healing and happiness for her.
Well, I think that that's really interesting. I mean, you're talking about the relationship between music and memory and joy, you know, that like you talk about the belly song, and that brings, I'm sure, an emotional connection between you and her, thinking about when you were young and feeling close and feeling happy and free, all of the things that would be a really positive connection to make. And Sherry, I understand from your research that some of these kind of positive emotional connections that come from music and that interaction, that you've seen very young children sort of pull on that in their cancer treatment. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So I think it's these associations that we have, right, with music, but also with memories. And, you know, when music is happening in our environment and what's happening around the environment, we do build memories and associations between those. So we were kind of talking during the break about how we're teaching young children and parents how to use music to help lower their stress and to help themselves to feel better when they're going through cancer. So initially, my expectation was somehow that parents would be taking the lead on, oh, you're not feeling so great, or you're not in a great mood space right now. Let's try some of the activities we tried in our music therapy session, because we give them kits and resources to use when the therapist is not there. But actually, most of the time, what we hear from parents is that their young child is the one who initiates using music to make themselves feel better. And when they witness this, they kind of have that realization of, oh yeah, this would be a good time to do that. And that's really working well. So for example, we had like a three-year-old who's waiting in a wagon or for a procedure, and they're getting anxious. And so they start to sing a song that they were using in their music session, or doing a finger play type of song to kind of help themselves relax. And so young kids build that association of, I was feeling bad, I had this music experience, I felt better, I want to feel better, I'm going to do that. And that just gets reinforced over time of, that works, and so I'm going to do it again. Or I feel bad and I want to feel better, that worked before, I'm going to try it again. Versus sometimes as adults, we have more cognitive engagement happening in the learning process that sometimes we have to overcome. I think it kind of feeds back to Becky's comment earlier about sometimes we have inhibitions as we age to being playful and creative and just giving it a go. And kids, sick kids are pretty remarkable that way. They'll be scooting down, doing their thing. They'll stop for a moment, get sick, and then they just pick back up and they keep moving along. And as adults, we kind of crawl into a bed and we curl up and we don't want to be bothered. But kids have this ability to overcome. So it's exciting to see that young children make that connection so quickly about how they can use music to kind of help make themselves feel better. And then in the process, they bring their parents along for the ride. So that's great.
You know, Sherry, that reminds me, you know, years ago, I was teaching in a fourth grade class, and you know how schools prepare everybody for tornado drills or a fire drill. And we kind of pseudo do it, you know, nobody really knows what it's going to be really like, because very few teachers have ever experienced one of those. But we experienced a series in Indianapolis of tornadoes that went through during the daytime. And we were in the basement of this building for 2.5 hours before we were allowed to come out. No bathrooms, nobody was prepared for that. No. But what I was able to do with a whole group, I mean, the entire school, all ages, was I was able to use hand and music games that I knew that I used with younger children. And I could use it with all of them, and they all calmed down, and they didn't have to go to the bathroom. Right. I mean, they kind of just forgot about everything. Mm-hmm. And so I'm only using that if that's a really good example of what you're talking about, where I think there's something that it can take us out of being upset. It can calm us. It made the teachers be better, and it's in our toolkit. And yes. I wish we, as parents and teachers and others, knew more to use it, to go ahead and risk using it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people do understand that intuitively, especially like, you know, maybe more at your elementary school levels. But, you know, there are lots of reasons why information is easier to remember when it's attached to music. Lots of discussions about music as a mnemonic device. You know, how many people have learned mathematics, you know, multiplication tables or presidents or United States, you know, lists of information that seem unrelated and difficult to memorize, but somehow when you put it to music, you're able to do that. And there are research that have looked at how does rhythm and melodic phrasing break up information into smaller chunks of information that allow you to input it into your short-term memory so that it's easier to access. You know, like the ABC song, I think there's short 7 slots in your short-term memory. So each phrase of the ABC song has 7 letters in it. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, you know, it's chaining. But then when you look at, if you look at the letters individually, that's unique bits of information. All of a sudden you've chunked it into sequences of information and you've attached it to a melody line that helps you remember. So, you know, music has been a great tool for children and individuals who process information differently or have challenges with memorizing information or recalling information. So that's great. But I think it's also, even for just your regular kids who don't maybe have learning challenges, it has power to really focus your attention and to help you regulate your attention in a time of stress. You were able to help those kids focus their attention on something, not the other things that were anxiety provoking. And that helped pass time, which our parents talk about too. Like when you're in the moment of music, that time is suspended and we're able to shift into a positive mood state. And that helps us, you know, and it gives us something to look forward to. And it, you know, so it's interesting how I think it's a lot to do with attention regulation, emotion regulation, and then also information, you know, how your brain processes information.
Can I ask, I'm just curious about, what about, actually creating music, kids, like, you know, selecting their own tones and the length and all that stuff? Because I know that personally, I can now kind of hover above myself and watch myself write. And I realize that I'm in a super peaceful state. And I can even say, I love what I'm doing right now. I'm totally in the moment making these little decisions. And I've taught lots of kids. I often, you know, the very first lesson with me, they're creating, they're choosing. So they're, you know, it's not just therapy with songs that are already invented, but like they're doing the inventing. Yeah. And how much peace and calm and slow breathing. I mean, it's just, I found it a healing thing for me. And I think, why am I not doing this all the time, you know, yeah. when I'm stressed out? How come I don't think, oh, I should go work on a song? You know, it's so helpful. And I forget sometimes, but yeah, I'm curious if that's part of music therapy, how that comes into play, I guess.
Yeah. And so you touch on, so music therapists use a lot of different types of experiences, and it just really depends on what it is that you're hoping to achieve. Mm-hmm. You know, when I've worked with adolescents and young adults with cancer, you know, the goal, sometimes the goal when I've worked with them, I've also worked with adolescents with significant burn injuries. Sometimes what we were wanting to accomplish with the music therapy was to have an opportunity for them to express and talk about what they're going through, what they've been through, you know, to have an outlet for expressing themselves and their feelings. And so sometimes music therapists will use songwriting as a way to do that. It could be, you know, lyric writing, but it also could just be music improvisation. Mm-hmm. So I use music improvisation in the tub room with kids that had like 90% total body surface area burns that were going through extreme amounts of pain, but as a way to, as an outlet for their pain and to help regulate what they were going through, we would actually do kind of call and response. So that's like kind of, for those of you that aren't music, kind of a copycat, I play something, you play something back, rhythms on drums. We've also done just, I've done improvised music and play with young kids who don't really have the verbal skills, but as we're playing out a play situation, they've been able to tell me how they ended up getting burned and what happened, and the emotions come through how they're playing their instrument, and we're able to move then into resolution of that through the music. So it's a way of processing that experience that may be verbal, but it might be nonverbal, all the way to like adolescents creating new compositions with lyrics that kind of tell their story to other people. Uh-huh. So there's like a whole range of ways that, of course, music can be used, and just depending on what it is that the music therapist is looking to accomplish, they'll choose the approaches. And, you know, some kids are more comfortable with lyrics, some are more comfortable with pre-composed music, some are more comfortable just playing in the moment. So you have to kind of figure that out too.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Sherry, one of the things that I'm curious about is, I know that increasingly in medical school and training now, that doctors are learning that there's a whole plethora of things other than what we typically call the science approach to medicine, even though you're adding the research to in a scientific way. But are you seeing much more not only acceptance, but almost prescribing or suggesting among new physicians that somebody might benefit from a particular therapy?
Yeah, I think we are seeing, worldwide, we're seeing greater recognition for, and I can just speak to music therapy because that's my area, but the use of music, we're getting growing evidence for certain areas of its application. So I believe it is in Norway, music therapy has been identified as a frontline recommended therapy for schizophrenia.
Wow.
And some personality disorders as being a helpful therapy. We're still growing the evidence base in disorders of aging, but this is a focal area right now for the NIH, which is having some discussion panels that anybody can attend if they want to hear the conversations about how do we advance the research to kind of better understand and refine these interventions so that they will become more readily accessible to the public, you know, either through a referral-based therapy or through a community-based music programs. The American Music Therapy Association continues to do advocacy efforts in the policy arena to help people understand under what circumstances might you want or need a music therapist, and recognizing their credentials and their training as an allied health service, which also helps with reimbursement for that as a clinical service. And you know, music therapy has been an allied health profession, like an organized allied health profession, since the 1950s. So we continue to see growth in that area. More and more people are aware of what it is and what the training of a music therapist is. So that's an area where we've seen a lot of growth. But I'm also excited to see that we're expanding it to include all of these applications so that we can, would love to see a time when we have people can easily access clinical services, but we also have a lot of support and funding to support more broad-based, community-based uses of music for health too.
Wow. Are you seeing anything in the research about music therapy related to pain management?
Yes. In fact, that's an area where it's been looked at quite a bit. We need to get more fine-tuned in understanding what the mechanisms of action are for pain. But I'll be collaborating on a project. I don't know that we can announce it specifically, but it will be looking at chronic pain and the use of music and music listening as a way to, and learning how to choose your music, like understanding what are my choices of music and how do I relate to music, to use music listening in an intentional way to help regulate your perceptions of pain. So that'll be exciting to see as well.
That's all really, really exciting stuff. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about the healing power of music, exploring physiological and psychological phenomena, and the ways playing music can help your brain. So as we went to the break, one of the things that I was interesting between hearing both of you talk, Becky and Sherry, is about how important collaboration is in the process of using music as a tool for healing. And Becky, I was thinking about sort of your relationship as, you know, you're talking about your students, and that sometimes when you bring your students on, actually creating music as a first step is almost more productive than just maybe playing pre-composed music. Can you talk a little bit about how you use music as a tool to build relationships?
In a teaching situation or in a performance situation or either?
Really, either is fine. I just think it's really exciting to think about the idea that like there's something that happens in the collaboration between us, music as the catalyst, that it may be different than just, you know, trying to have a conversation.
I mentioned that I teach, I often, in the first lesson, I want them to know that they can do it. I think part of it is that, you know, that they can write, that they can come up with ideas themselves, because I was not encouraged when I was young. It didn't dawn on me. I just figured, you know, music was written by men who are now dead, you know. So I like to, and Sherry had mentioned call and response, and I do a little thing at a first lesson, and often we continue it because they like it so much, but I just call it copycat. I play five notes or less. They copy me. I say, it's your turn. They play five notes or less. I copy them. So we're having this wonderful conversation, and so much is happening in five or less notes. They are being validated for their ideas. They are listening intently. So they're copying, you know, I mean, the more we do it, the more they start really copying, not just note, not just, you know, the tones, the rhythm, the touch. And it's just, it's so powerful. And I feel like I'm doing a very good service for them, because I've lifted them up and given them immediate control and power. I was working with a brand new student who they were considering whether they wanted to do lessons. So they came this summer, I have a big window right by the piano. So I'm looking outside, and I say, sometimes I see something outside. It makes me want to create something. And I said, why don't you show me something that you'd like me to make a song with? She showed me a swing, and I said, so you want me to make something with the swing swinging? No, with it standing still. So I tried making something up, and it, you know, wasn't fantastic. But then I said, well, how about if you show me what you would do with it? And she played three notes. She goes, I don't know. But even though she said that, she still found a way to express herself. And she didn't have someone say, now, that's not how we're supposed to, you know. I went along with it. I thought it was fantastic. So that there's that in the teaching moment that I found really, it's just empowering. I like that word. I like to be an empowerer. As far as collaborating with others, oh my gosh, well, especially after almost a year of not getting to play, I started having this series in my driveway last September. And the first time people came, just seeing my friends who I hadn't played with in so long, it was so emotional. And they're really top notch players. This was, my little jazz combo. But even they said, it's like we're starting all over. We have to remember how to communicate again, because we haven't had this experience, that experience of listening to each other. Something I've learned a lot from, especially, well, this guitarist I play with, his name's Sandy Williams. He's really taught me how to listen and respond. Like, I'll play something that I feel like, if we're in an improv situation and I play something and I think, oh, that was terrible, why did I do that? And he'll pick up on it and he'll play it back, kind of like the copycat story. And he'll play it back to me, and it's as if he's saying, oh, that's interesting, let me work with that. And it's so validating. And it's all of a sudden I'm relaxed, I'm happy, he's heard me. Just like a real, you know, when we talk to each other, if I make it clear that I've heard what you said and I respond to what you said, not responded by saying some preconceived thing, it's such a wonderful community experience. And I'm learning to do that too. He's the master at it. But I'm learning to, that's great. He's listening to me. I need to listen to him and respond the same way. And he'll comment the same kind of thing that, thank you, that you heard me, you know.
What I really like about what you're saying, Becky, and it really falls within what some of Sherry's talking about, is some of it is that you're having a conversation through music when you might not be able to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just because, Sherry, the topic's just too difficult with cancer or whatever to just directly talk about. But you're able, through music, to go somewhere else and have that conversation. Sounds so powerful.
Yeah, and I think something that seems intuitive, but I think sometimes people forget when we're talking about therapy or clinical uses of music, is that whole relational collaborative piece is really essential. And I think there's been a huge shift, you know, in both perspectives about mental health services and therapy, is that you don't go to work with a therapist to have them do something to you. You go there to work together collaboratively on something that's a challenge in your life, and music may be a way to address that and you know, in a way that maybe another modality hasn't been able to address in the past. So, you know, the relational piece of music is quite powerful. The fact that it is such a multi-sensory experience that doesn't necessarily rely on words, and has the capacity to harness, you know, or touch into the emotional aspect, is really important. So, you know, part of what we do with the young child intervention are the same principles that you would see in a really highly effective teaching environment, where you're creating a safe space that meets people where they are, and the therapist is noticing how the child and parent are responding to each other and to the music, and then they're adjusting pieces of the experience to help either give more support or more space, so that you can get them to engage. And, you know, if people don't engage in the experience, they're not going to get any benefit. It's like a prerequisite. So one of the probably the hardest things to overcome in mental health therapies is if you don't feel like it's a safe to trust space and like it has value for you and you don't engage, you probably won't get a lot of benefit. So I think the topic of relational experiences, collaborative experiences, are really at the center of music and music therapy in particular, for the area of work that I'm doing.
It's so many ideas and ways that we can use alternative pathways to communicate with one another is so exciting to me. To imagine, you know, it's often that we feel like if we lose some sense of our sight or we have something happen cognitively that, you know, we're going to be lost. But in another way, we as humans have this great capacity to have all kinds of ways of stimulating our brain and communicating with one another. And Becky, that brings me back to that. I love that idea of the person you were talking about just tapping too on you. I mean, on, you know, it that... That was a way of actually making a personal communication to you.
I actually wrote a piece because of it. And I wanted to write a piece for my friend Karen. And that's, you know, I was thinking, you know, I could write it. She's Irish. I could write it with some kind of Irish lilt, you know, or something. But all I know is the rhythm of that tapping was going to appear in the song. That's what I based the song around. It's called "Still Something to Say." It chokes me up just to say that title. And it's on my CD, and it's also on YouTube. if anyone wants to look up I wrote it when I got home from seeing her. She lived in California. And I wrote it as quick as I could, because I thought she's not going to have much longer. So I wrote the piece. I hurried and made a video tape of myself playing it, and I sent it to her. And it's just a very, very, you know, because she's in it. She's really in it.
We want to thank
you. Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to. validate Becky's story. And just, I think it's just a beautiful example of how music is a tool for healing for all of us, right? That it's not just necessarily for that person that's experiencing the illness. And I think that that's what Sherry sort of talked about as well, not just for the person experiencing the illness, but for all of those of us who love and caregivers, that that having access to these spaces is really powerful. So thanks, Becky, for sharing that.
Thank you, Becky. I want to thank both you, Becky, and Sherry Robb from helping us really explore the power of music in ways that, you know, I hadn't really thought about, and it was so inspiring, and I hope to our listeners during a time sometimes when we have to hunker down, when we're afraid of things like a virus, that it could be really helpful to all of us to remember that music might be a way of renewing our spirit and helping ourselves to heal.
You'll find pictures of Becky and Sherry's projects and links to those projects, not only of their work, but also of our other guests on the Da Vinci Pursuit website at thedavincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls. So artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations like this one.
And for both Krista and I, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedavincipursuit.com.